Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on U.S. Out of Africa, Then What? Our moderator today is Professor Jeremy Rabkin. Professor Rabkin is a professor of law at George Mason's Antonin Scalia Law School. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Rabkin, thank you for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. A few months ago, I saw in the newspaper, maybe the Washington Post, but the U.S. was proposing to withdraw its troops from Niger. And I asked people in our Federalist Society practice group on international and national security law, did you know we had troops there? And these are all people sort of paying attention, and nobody knew that we had had troops there. So maybe we could start with, what were they doing there to begin with? Cameron Hudson, you volunteered to say something about this.
Sure, happy to start. Well, the short answer is they were there operating two bases, two drone bases that the United States built in starting in around 2016, 2017, became fully operational around 2020, and housed about 1,000 U.S. service members in Niger. This is, I think, an evolution of the force structure and composition that we have seen traditionally in that part of Africa. You'll remember that during the Trump administration in 2017, four U.S. service members, Green Berets, were killed in Niger, accompanying Nigerian counterparts on a raid on suspected Al-Qaeda targets inside of Niger. And so at that point, the U.S. military presence was very much at the tip of the spear. We were shoulder to shoulder with local counterterrorism operators on the ground in Niger and Mali. And after that tragic raid and the death of those service members, I think it woke up many people, particularly in the Trump administration, who didn't realize, you know, at the White House that we had these forces there and that they had been there in some way, shape or form since 2012, 2013, when Mali started to experience the terrorist violence. Much of it was a spillover from the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in Libya and the kind of arms bazaar that flowed into the Sahelian states of Africa as that regime crumbled. And so the United States had been slowly getting more and more involved in assisting with counterterrorism operations, but also putting U.S. soldiers really on the front lines. And so from that moment, I think the Trump administration ordered a kind of top-down review of what forces we had positioned across Africa, not just in the Sahel, but in Somalia and other parts of Africa, where we have had a troop presence, particularly carrying out counterterrorism operations, but not exclusively, and was, I think, really moving towards withdrawing those forces from Africa on national security grounds, essentially saying that you know, putting these guys in harm's way doesn't sort of meet a threshold for risk that we should be willing to take in a place like Niger, where it's not a kind of first tier national security interest of the United States. He was largely able to do that in Somalia, removing many U.S. forces from Somalia. The general at the time commanding those troops sort of wryly said that he had to commute to work, so they repositioned them in Kenya, and the counterterrorism operations continued to a lesser degree in Somalia. But in Niger, what we saw was more of a pivot away from frontline troops to a kind of intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance operation that aided local partners, provided them with intelligence and battlefield intelligence, but not having soldiers on the front line.
Could you say a word, or anybody else who might know about this? I think it's 2007 when we set up AFRICOM, the Africa Command, which means even before, some years before the fall of Gaddafi, there was this sense in the Defense Department, we need to be organized to have a, to coin a phrase, Pan-Africa perspective. What was that about?
Well, I'm happy to take the lead and let others chime in. But, you know, I was there in the Bush administration when the Africa Command was rolled out. And so I think at that time, it was both a reflection of the fact that Africa was the only what they call AOR, area of responsibility for the U.S. military, was where there wasn't a combatant command dedicated to Africa. Any operations that had to be conducted in Africa, whether they be humanitarian that the U.S. military would do, whether they were counterterrorism or whether they were security cooperation, were all done out of the European command in Germany. And I think there was a growing understanding in the Bush administration that Africa was of growing importance and of growing national security importance to the United States. And so they wanted to put Africa within the defense community on a more equal footing. Hence the creation of the Africa Command. What I would say, however, though, is that the Africans were not particularly keen to having a large command on the continent. We maintain a small permanent base in Djibouti, which is largely for logistics and intelligence, but has a very small command structure, force structure. So the Africans themselves were not particularly keen on a large, you know, U.S. base anywhere on the continent, which is why to this day, the Africa Command is still headquartered in Germany, even though it is aimed at Africa. And I would also note that it controls no military assets of its own. So if it wants to deploy tanks or helicopters or battle groups of any kind, it has to borrow those forces from other combatant commands. It is really focused on security cooperation and a kind of a third leg of a diplomatic and developmental stool that the United States uses in Africa.
Could you just say in 2007 was the anticipated threat mostly to do with terror networks, or in 2007 did they already have a thought that Russia and China might be intervening in Africa in ways that we'd want to be able to counter?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we certainly did not see the threat from Russia and China anywhere near the way we see it today in 2007, nor were the terror networks particularly, you know, as robust as we see them now. But of course, in the wake of 9/11, which was, you know, just a few years prior to the establishment of AFRICOM, there was a concern about a kind of global war on terror. You had the Shabab coming into existence in Somalia, which remains a top tier terrorist organization for the United States. So there was a burgeoning concern that that terrorism could grip Africa. There was early concern that as we drove terrorist forces out of Afghanistan and Pakistan, that they would find their way, much as Osama bin Laden did in the 1990s, to parts of Africa. So I think that was a kind of over the horizon threat that Washington recognized early.
Yeah. So let me shift to Michael Rubin. You've written about this. As I understand it, the Biden administration has agreed to this withdrawal from Niger because there came to be a new government there, I think, after a coup, which said you should leave. And we had previously left Somalia. But it might be that these are just sort of local fluctuations, and really we still have this capacity and this commitment to be prepared in Africa. But some people, I think, including you, have expressed concern that there's an overall trend towards American disengagement. I want to start with just this direct question to you. Is that how you feel on October 16th, that the trend is toward American disengagement?
Let me put it this way, Professor Rabkin. Not only in Africa, but elsewhere, there tends to be a gap between American rhetoric and the reality of American policy. And for those in Washington, that gap is a familiar artifact of the sausage making, which is policy across both Democratic and Republican administrations. But too often on the ground in places like Africa or the Middle East or elsewhere, when people see this gap between rhetoric or reality, they interpret it, they perceive it in a way that might actually be corrosive to American policy. So yes, I don't think we're engaging enough. That said, Joe Biden appears set to make his last trip as president of the United States to Angola in an effort to highlight a corridor, a rail corridor, a trade corridor that will move towards westward towards the Atlantic Ocean in a conscious effort to compete with China, to pivot the orientation of trade from the Indian Ocean basin towards the Atlantic Ocean basin. Unfortunately, that may be too little too late. And across both Republican and Democratic administrations, we tend to have a tendency to virtue signal our commitment. And while we're virtue signaling our commitment rhetorically, the Chinese are building infrastructure, whether it's needed or not is another question, right outside the presidential palace in Bangui in the Central African Republic. I stumbled across a monument that was built to celebrate the Wagner Group, protecting the Central Africans from all sorts of ills. And it's that sort of on the ground propaganda that the United States is not good at countering.
Yeah, you're saying they have a presence and we are shadowy and remote.
I would say that. And one additional point I would make, Professor Rabkin, is that United States policy still seems geared to a perception of Africa that we hold that's actually rooted in the way Africa was 20 years ago, rather than the way Africa is today. And that can lead to a dissidence in policy. But when you said with regard to the Sahel, I mean, is this simply just sort of a local issue? When we have the broad picture, you can see the ebbs and flows of stability and instability in Africa. And this is certainly the case in the Sahel. A lot of people forget that Mali was once seen as the poster child of democracy and stability. It was rated free by Freedom House and had successive democratic elections. Now it's a Russian satrapy, depending on who you talk to. But in general, in Southern Africa, in portions of Central Africa, they're certainly not the Democratic Republic of Congo. In Somaliland, which we don't recognize, democracy is on the march in a very positive way, and we undermine our national interests when we ignore what is going on in Africa.
Okay, I want to spend most of our time talking about what the stakes are there. But before we get any further, I want to bring in Tom Lee, just to clarify the legal framework here. So as I understand it, we've had some military deployments over three successive administrations. Troops go in for different purposes, they're withdrawn, maybe they go back. That seems to be what happened in Somalia. They were there, they were withdrawn, they were sent back. Just first make this clear to us, Tom. Is this totally up to the president? Just as a matter of law, he can deploy these troops and he can withdraw them, and it's his call and he needs no authority from Congress?
So, thank you, Jeremy. You know, in terms of legal authorities, lawyers typically talk about two tracks, sort of international law and U.S. law. And so I'll talk similarly along those two tracks. And one comment I had about AFRICOM, and I'd be curious to hear Cameron's amplification. Many years ago, and when I was in the Navy, I remember, you know, Somalia operations, anti-piracy, and I was under the impression that that was part of PACOM. So that was another piece. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the genesis of AFRICOM, the extent to which those operations and having them chop over to a centralized command was part of the thinking, because I'd sort of wondered from my own personal curiosity about that. So to onto the U.S. legal authorities, you know, obviously for the counterterror, a principal authority is the 2001 authorization of use of military force related to 9/11. And so that is still active. And so to the extent that we can trace a genealogy from any of these groups, Al-Qaeda, and the backward-looking piece is connection to the 9/11 attacks. The president has sort of this vested authority. There is also a forward-looking aspect. They have to be planning this sort of terrorist actions in the future, or aiding and abetting, or so forth. But the prospective hook is generally not a problem. So those are a set of very robust congressional executive authorities that exist for anti-terrorism ops. When you get into things that don't fall comfortably within the 9/11 AUMF, then things get a little bit trickier, because then you're relying on, there are some statutory treaty authorities, but they're, you know, embassy defense. So, and I'm not going to talk about Title 10 or Title 50, the ISR statute or the covert action statute, but in terms of a traditional, no, we don't want anyone to go to jail for conversations we have on a Zoom here. But in terms of sort of military activities, you know, the test is, where the president perceives national interests and the particular actions are determined not to rise to the level of war. So the biggest basket there is self-defense. Obviously, if there's a situation where the president perceives U.S. troops are at risk, or U.S. property, U.S. persons, then he can use force. That includes, many years ago, there was planning, you know, the Liberia non-combatant evacuation operations. So if there's a crisis somewhere, the president has unilateral authority to order the Marines in, or whatever expeditionary force, to evacuate not just U.S. nationals, but third country nationals. I think this is particularly relevant as we see some crisis situations evolve. Also within that, and generally, I said there was a two-pronged test. Are there national interests? Are these steps, do they rise to the level of war? Generally, humanitarian evacuation operations do involve the significant introduction of armed forces, but generally the lawyers say that the authorities are robust. It gets complicated in terms of relief, access, the actual deployment of troops, naval ships, and so forth, but that kind of thing is generally accepted. What other types of scenarios, like let's say there's a genocide? I mean, it's a public opinion in the Trump administration, the Syria use of chemical weapons. One of the aspects of the natural interest analysis there talked about regional stability, and also arguments based on sort of the humanitarian crisis developing, right? And so it seems to me that it would be plausible for a president who chooses to intervene in some limited way in a humanitarian crisis other than an evacuation operation to make some kind of argument. I mean, it would have to be more of a one-off rather than a sustained military operation. It's hard to conceive of, from an operational perspective, what that might look like in a genocide type situation. But I think that from a U.S. perspective, those are sort of the set of legal authorities that I think are most relevant to Africa operations. Over.
Do you want to say a word about international law constraints?
This is the Federalist Society. Am I supposed to talk about those?
Just very briefly.
Chair says,
yes, we'd like to have you. Does that end the legal question?
Right. So you know, Security Council authorization is sort of the gold standard. I mean, I think in this current environment, that's not likely to happen on many Africa-related issues for the geopolitical factors that Michael and Cameron have talked a bit about and you've hinted to. Self-defense is a valid justification, and that includes own force self-defense. So we have I don't know what the official count is in Djibouti. We've got 2,000 plus, you know, forces there. And so if they're being attacked, they can engage in proportionate response to attack. And then there's always invitation, which is if one of the countries actually invites us to participate, I mean, that's considered a valid ground under international law. It's disputed whether humanitarian intervention, like in a genocide Rwanda type situation, whether that's a freestanding ground independent of Security Council resolution. The Belgians, the British, several European countries think it is. The United States official position is that it isn't. But there is sort of this argument out there among some countries that there's a sort of a customary international law norm that if there's sufficient evidence of a grave genocide, then unilateral intervention or collective intervention short of Security Council authorization is lawful.
But that is something on a huge and terrifying scale. It's not just terrorism. Yes,
that's right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's dig into current concerns. I want to go back to start with to Michael Rubin. Seems to me if your concern is to demonstrate a presence, like we care about you and we're engaged and we want to be your partners, it's maybe not necessarily the best thing to have a military deployment with drone operators? Or is there some way in which actually, no, that's good too, because it shows that we're prepared to kill and be killed?
No, it's a great question. First of all, let me start with my broader framework, is that when a vacuum exists, it's seldom the forces of altruism which fill it. It's rather groups like the Islamic State or the Russians, or you can name any sorts of other malign groups or ideologies. Now, getting to your point, does it necessarily need to be filled by the military? The answer to that is no. Although sometimes when there is a real security concern, having a military presence or working through some of the local militaries tends to be a good option. Look, if the United States isn't truly going to get involved in Africa, I rather, for example, work with India, which has local experience from its diaspora communities on the continent and can fill the vacuum in a way which is a lot less deleterious to security. Now, if we were going to bring on the military side, building up local capacity, a soldier from Chad or a soldier from Somaliland, and plop them at the Naval Postgraduate School, they're going to be like a fish out of water when it comes to some of the topics that are taught. So to kill two birds with one stone, what I would actually do from a policy perspective is let's find good military academies in the region, in Malawi, in Ghana, in Rwanda, and actually work by offering scholarships to get interoperability among some of the local African states. If we're instructors there, just as with the Marshall Center in Garmisch, Germany, it gives us an intelligence perspective. It helps build the relationships, but it also builds the interoperability and allows Africans to learn African lessons from other Africans rather from Americans with their 8,000-mile screwdriver. So I do think we can do a lot more with less. Many of you may be familiar with the Olmsted Fellowships, which are like the Rhodes Scholarship of the military community, where you have 05s, 06s, lieutenant colonels, colonel level, who are selected to go to foreign military staff colleges, study and live with host families. Why are we doing this with London or Paris when we could be doing this with Kinshasa or Kigali? That is how I would actually more creatively assert American, if you will, interest and leadership on the continent. And the last point I would make is what has frustrated me, and this isn't just an Africa thing. When the U.S. president, Democratic or Republican, travels, they fill Air Force One with journalists. When President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey or Emmanuel Macron in France or the Chancellor of Germany or the President of Russia in the past would travel, they fill their planes with businessmen. And that ultimately is how you build the relationship, which is what your question was getting at. But with that, let me turn the floor back to you.
Yeah. So this reminds me of this startling fact that I learned serving at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We actually do invest in training people to do various kind of peacekeeping missions in Africa. The country that does either the most or the second most training of people to do these missions is China, which is like really startling. And you'd have to think they're extremely desperate if they're taking their instruction from China. But I mean, they are sort of engaged at some level, even at this training level.
Very quickly, one of those issues, and I just throw it out there without an answer, because legally it's interesting. I've embedded myself a couple times with the Rwandans in northern Mozambique, in the Central African Republic. And given that you have UN peacekeeping, which is hit and miss, you've had successful peacekeeping missions, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, they've picked up, folded up shop, gone home when they established their missions. Then you have others like in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which are, just not the most effective, multi-billion dollar operations, which have continued for decades. What the Rwandans have done is married bilateral deployments to UN deployments. So they get the legitimacy of the UN, but if it comes to chasing after a particular fugitive and interrogating him to get actionable intelligence with a ticking clock, their bilateral side will do that and share the intelligence with the United Nations rather than go through the bureaucracy of the UN, which will take 3 weeks or more. And so it's been a model which has been very successful, but it's also interesting, and you need to have the head of the local UN mission be from the same nationality as the bilateral deployment. So two groups operating under different rules.
So I want to focus for a minute on Russia, because it seems to me that Russia really is, in economic terms, just a pygmy. It's not buying a lot. It's not selling a lot. And the Wagner Group is the one important export, so far as I understand it, which is, do you need to intimidate people? We have people who are really good at that, and we would be happy to make them available to you. Does the success of Wagner in getting itself, is hired the right word, contracted? Anyway, they found a lot of business opportunities there. Does that in itself suggest the United States has, fallen down in its responsibility or its capacity? Or is it that they are offering a level of brutality that we couldn't possibly compete with? So we have to think of a different way of responding to that, but it's not trying to be a better behaved Wagner. Do you have an opinion about that, Cameron? And then I'll come back to you, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reasons for Wagner are many, quite frankly, some of which are a response to their relationships with not just the United States, but the West, I think, more broadly. But I think, first, it's important to just look at where the Wagner Group is engaged or has been engaged in the last a few years in Africa, and they're in weak and failing states. These are not in democratic states. These are not in states with strong institutions. So it's the Sahelian states, Mali, Burkina, now Niger. It's Sudan during its war. It's the Central African Republic. Incredibly weak states. And I think that if you think of the Wagner Group almost as a virus, then it looks for certain conditions in its host in order to take root and to take hold and to thrive, right? And it requires weak states and weak institutions, some level of chaos or instability. Typically, there's a component of commerce, so whether it's mineral rights or logging rights or some way for this deployment to self-finance is typical. In order for it to self-finance and in order for a government to sign away logging rights or mineral rights, that's not a regime that is going to be in any way answerable to their people, right? And so those are the kinds of places where the Wagner Group has found success. Conversely, those are the kinds of places where the United States has a very difficult time operating, again, because of our laws and our legislation, most of which prevent us from, I mean, I'm talking about a lot of junta governments here, not all, but many junta governments. And therefore, we are constrained by what we can do and how we can do it and what we can call it, not just from a legal perspective, but then, you know, from a values perspective. And I think, you know, sort of borrowing a little bit from what Mike was saying earlier, I think, you know, we talk a lot about our values, especially in Africa. We talk about, you know, the Biden administration has talked a lot about its values for democracy and human rights. And I think the challenge is that, you know, when that is your kind of, you know, top priority, then when you have a case like in Niger, where, you know, we had $100 million drone base that we were operating and we were working very closely with that government, and it was giving us all kinds of access to a very broad region, frankly, from Libya, Sudan, all across the Sahel, you know, geographically, that was a very central base for us. You know, you lose that base. And there's a big gap that exists as a result, and that the Russians have been able to backfill very quickly. So I do think that we often face challenges. Again, the appeal of the Wagner Group in many ways is also a function of our own colonial history and the Western kind of colonial history. Even though we weren't on a colonizer in Africa, I think a lot of Africans see us as colonizers because of our control of the World Bank and the IMF and the UN, or what they perceive to be our control of those institutions, which impose, you know, harsh conditionalities on them for loans, for, you know, those kinds of things. And so they have come to see the United States and France and the Brits and others as a malign force ourselves, even though we don't see ourselves that way. And I think Russia and the Wagner Group has been able to stoke that in these countries very adeptly, either through misinformation, disinformation. But as I say all the time, Russia is not powerful enough to shape the public opinion of these countries all by itself. It doesn't have as many trolls and bots and things to make that. But what it can do is it can germinate these feelings where there's already a seed that's been planted. And in many cases, we have planted that seed. And so Wagner itself, I think, is an alternative to the U.S.-led, Western-led kind of security approach. You know, in Africa. I'll give you just one short anecdote. I was in Mali earlier this year, and I was meeting with members of the junta, talking to them about the Wagner Group. And they said, you know, when the French were here in our country, they told us what the mission was. They led on the mission. They told us what role we would have. And if we were lucky enough, we could ride on the helicopter with them up to this terrorist target. But they picked the target. They picked the mission. They did everything. And we were a guest in our own country, carrying out counterterrorism operations against forces that were breaking away from the central state. He said, when we got rid of the French and when we brought the Russians in, we then got in the driver's seat. We tell the Russians what the operation is. We tell them what their role is. They back us up, but we lead. And that's the way it should be in our own country. And I think there's a real appeal to that, that sentiment among many of the African countries that we're talking about empowering them. Again, I think that there's this perspective that the Wagner Group is leading these countries around by the nose. And that's not entirely the case. I think for many of these countries, they feel very empowered, not only by having kicked out Western forces, but by being in charge of their own internal security operations. And I think we need to remember that as we try to approach, you know, new partners in Africa and what the tenor of that relationship is going to be.
Yeah. Michael, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Look, I largely, as often, agree with Cameron and what he's saying. Another way to frame what Cameron was just saying with the Wagner Group being allowed to be in the driver's seat is in Mali, what I've heard from a number of people, they're willing to do what the French weren't willing to do. And that can sometimes bleed into ethnic reprisals and that sort of issue. The other point with the Wagner is while they tend to be lionized in the popular press in the United States, they've also had notable failures in Africa. For example, in Mozambique, where the Rwandans and the South Africans replaced them because they weren't able to actually adequately counter the Al-Qaeda-based insurgency in Cabo Delgado. So what the United States needs to do is focus a little bit more on studying Wagner failures rather than assuming that they're always going to default to success. The only other points I would make is, look, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you're lawyers, everything looks like a legal framework, and I don't deny that. But what also hampers American action in the region is this growing tendency, and again, across administrations, where we want to reset the calendar every 4 years, and strategy doesn't necessarily conform to our own political calendar in that way. And the last and final point I would make is Cameron is absolutely right that Russia takes advantage of this anti-colonial narrative. And Cameron is right about the perception of the United States through our domination of certain international institutions. The only thing I would add is that there are other countries that try to latch on to this sort of anti-colonial narrative alongside Russia. So, for example, Turkey, which I would argue as a Middle Eastern historian was one of the great imperial powers, actually will go around the region and say that they are the anti-colonial power. And Erdogan will actually cite Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in this. And it has reticence. Turkey has its largest overseas military base now in Somalia, in Mogadishu. And so we do need to be cognizant of this so that we don't suffer the same fate that the French have, or at least we can see it coming as the door gets slammed in our face.
Yeah. So I want to spend just a few minutes talking about China, and then we can come back to like what America can and can't do. It seems to me China is really, at least potentially, in a very different position from Russia, because it can cultivate extensive economic ties with various countries in Africa. But both as a buyer of African raw materials, but also as a provider of services in construction and in other areas. So potentially China is a more robust and long-term player there. Would it be wrong to view this as almost a zero-sum relationship with American interests? The more China expands its engagement, the more threatening that is to the United States, or is that too alarmist or pessimistic? I'll start with Cameron, and we'll come back to you in a minute, Mac.
Well, Professor, I would say that it shouldn't be a zero-sum game, but I think a lot of people in Washington view it as a zero-sum game. I think, you know, maybe a more optimistic view would be that we should be growing the pie rather than fighting over slices that don't get any bigger. I think, you know, when you think about China, when I think about China in Africa, you know, Washington missed the boat, I think, on China's ascendancy on the continent. By about 20 years or more. China had a strategy for Africa that included the Belt and Road, but is not exclusively about the Belt and Road, which Washington did not have. Washington was focused largely on a humanitarian relationship, whether it's our emergency plan for AIDS relief, whether it's our presidential malaria initiative, whether it's our Power Africa initiative. You know, we have all of these presidential initiatives to do good works in Africa, and we tout our $11 billion food aid budget for Africa. You know, all of this happening across, you know, the last four administrations, when the Africans have been telling us we want trade, not aid. We don't want that relationship of unequals to persist. And, you know, I was in Angola not long ago. We were talking about Angola earlier. There are over 1,500 Chinese companies in Angola right now. Most of them are one and two man operations. So if you're a young Chinese entrepreneur looking to make it rich, the land of opportunity is Africa. It is not China, right? It is Africa. And so you have, by the thousands, Chinese entrepreneurs going to Africa, doing small deals, growing those deals, bringing their families. You know, we cannot incentivize enough American companies to want to go to Africa, right? We have these presidential initiatives now under our Development Finance Corporation, and it was referenced earlier, this Lobito Corridor. I don't know if that's a scalable or a replicable project. It has taken very much a whole of government to try to launch this initiative, which is I think drawn from the Belt and Road playbook. But the fact is, I think we will struggle to compete with the Chinese until our private sector sees what China's private sector sees in Africa. And I think that's going to be very difficult. I mean, I was talking about this the other day, and, you know, on the front page of the New York Times, the day I was talking about was a monkeypox outbreak in the Congo and the civil war in Sudan. And that is how most U.S. Media treat Africa. That is, you know, that is the view of Africa today. That view trickles into the debt markets and finance markets and entrepreneurial markets and the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. And so that's how our business community largely perceives of Africa is a continent of risk, right? And risk mitigation. And what we have seen is our government is only going to be so successful in trying to mitigate that risk if the rest of our business community and our media community don't also see many of the same opportunities that the Chinese see in Africa. I don't think that it's necessarily that the Chinese are so risk tolerant. I just think that they perceive of that risk differently. And then the last thing I would say on that is that I think there is an appeal in many ways to the Chinese model. So it's not just that we're having a harder time competing because of our own constraints and biases. It's also because the Chinese, they come into these countries and they say, you know, to Zambia, they say, China was you 40 years ago. We were a poor agrarian nation with no urbanization, with no electricity. And in the span of two generations, we have become the second largest economy in the world, and we can help you do that, right? We know the secret recipe for taking poor agrarian economies and turning them into modern economies, and let us help you do that. That's a very powerful argument, and it's honestly one that we can't make because we haven't been a poor agrarian economy for hundreds of years, right? And so there is a Chinese model that is proximate. And they sell that model to Africans, whether or not it is loaded with debt that they don't want, or, you know, other kind of trapdoors that benefit the Chinese more than the Africans. That's a different story, and we can talk about that. But I do think that there's an appeal that China makes, that their entrepreneurial class and their officials make, that we really can't compete on in any way in the United States.
But perhaps some of our allies could do that. The Germans could say they were a broken, rubble-strewn country just two generations ago. And the Poles could say they were hopeless after two generations of communism. And look what they've done in just 30 years.
I think it's probably more compelling to hear that from the Emiratis or the Turks or the Egyptians or the Saudis who say, you know, we were just wandering the desert 50 years ago and now look at us, right?
So this is actually a question from the audience that's very pertinent to this discussion. To what extent is the U.S. government's views on various social issues that are highly different from African values leading to African nations preferring Chinese or Russian partners? Maybe we hector these countries about human rights in ways that it doesn't occur to the Russians or the Chinese, and maybe that's a real comparative disadvantage. Michael Rubin, I think, wants to say something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because this is a complaint I hear repeatedly in various countries to which I go, and it certainly is corrosive to America's policy in the region, that we try to make square pegs fit into round holes. So I've heard numerous times in Africa, how can you tell us to be against female genital mutilation? And at the same time, the next week, without a sense of irony, come to us under the guise of LGBTQ policies and say that you have to have transgender sex reassignment and so forth. Isn't that simply genital mutilation? And the answer is yes. And at the same time, they will say, look, you've got to respect African values. That doesn't mean that they are that they will never change. But in certain countries, for example, Uganda, you can have someone who's going to come to the family dinner with their roommate of 20 years, and a nod and a wink, everyone in their family knows what that roommate is. But it's simply not said, much in the same way that in the United States in the 1950s or 1960s, we would have that same setup. But as soon as you have a foreign power saying you've got to respect LGBTQ policies, then suddenly you create a backlash and you promote societal fissures that actually do more harm than good and hamper you in getting to that broader end goal of tolerance that sometimes we tend to navel gaze in the United States. And it is very imperial to come in and try to run roughshod over local culture and to do it with a sense of progressive arrogance only makes it more impalatable to people in the region. Climate change is another issue we do that on, but I can turn the floor back.
Slightly different focus, but another question that we had was, do you anticipate any African nation, I guess, other than South Africa, becoming a member of the BRICS? That economic partnership, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, they're having a meeting just in the end of October. And do any of you think that BRICS partnership has a conceived African strategy?
Answer that. I think that, you know, we saw the BRICS expand for the first time last year to include now Ethiopia and Egypt. So there are now three countries in the BRICS plus that are African. And that was something that was pushed for by South Africa. It also includes, incidentally, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Iran. So I think there is a question as to which direction the BRICS are going to take, and I think that the upcoming BRICS summit will do much to kind of shed light on that, whether BRICS is emerging as a kind of alternative to a kind of G7 orientation in world governance and global governance, whether its intent is to create a kind of parallel currency market to de-dollarize. Many of these countries already are trading in non-dollar denominated currencies for their own bilateral exchanges. What the South Africans have said, at least, is that they don't see an additional round of expansion of the BRICS anytime soon, and they're not supportive of a new expansion. I think my sense is that they're going to see, they're all going to see how the incorporation of these new countries works out. They will set a new agenda. They have said that their agenda is really on trade amongst the BRICS powers. So we will see if they hew to that role. I think, though, that we have to assume and believe that over time, certainly as we invest more in, for example, the G7, for example, our sanctions on Russia were driven out of the G7. You see the United States taking actions, in the international system outside of, for example, the UN. Our invasion of Libya was done through NATO. Yes, we got a Security Council mandate because we wanted cover legally, but that was a NATO operation. We use the G7 to impose sanctions on Russia when we can't get them through the Security Council. So I do think that, we are seeing the BRICS possibly emerge as a bloc that can do the same thing. And so for us we should be concerned about that in the long term. But I think we have some responsibility for letting the genie out of the bottle, because we have been, using these ad hoc coalitions and ad hoc groupings to advance our own national security interests. If these countries are now going to do that, then I think, we probably have something to do with having planted that seed originally.
Before we finish, I want to get a little bit of discussion about American politics. And maybe all of you will say, that's not my field, I study other things, but I get your soundings for what they're worth. I noticed when I was doing a little research for this forum, there was actually a motion by Congressman Matt Gaetz to say, because he also learned that we had troops in Africa and looked up and said, whoa, what's that? Let's have a motion now in the House of Representatives to bring them home. And I think he got like 100 votes, which are almost entirely Republicans, but it's getting to almost half of the Republican caucus. Maybe they voted for it, a lot of people, just as a something to tell their voters, and they knew that it wouldn't pass. But do you think that there is a political current in the country which make it harder to sustain engagement with Africa? And do you have any, I guess, two related questions. Does this turn on the outcome of the November national elections here? Will that make a big difference? And regardless of who wins, are there things that we could do? I don't know who the we is, but people who are concerned about this, to try to shore up American willingness to engage with Africa. Anyone want to start on that? I'll go back to Michael Rubin, because American Enterprise comes with your title, right?
Fair enough. I would go, the short answer is yes. This is a broader trend among both Democrats and Republicans. It's philosophical, it's not partisan, and in my viewpoint, it's corrosive to the American national interest. What could we do to shore up our presence? Let me give you an American Enterprise Institute answer, even though we don't take institutional positions, of course. It's become almost a mantra that we should be supporting small and family-owned businesses. I would argue that it's much better to support multinational corporations going into Africa. And the reason for that is this. I'm a frequent visitor to Somaliland, the unrecognized country that broke away. It's the northern third of Somalia. And Berbera, of course, now has the top port, according to the World Bank, in Africa. When Dubai World took over the port of Berbera, they shut it down for 2 weeks. The Somalilanders were afraid that they were going to be thrown out of work. They retrained them. They increased their wages about 90%. And now every time I go back to Berbera, I see follow-on restaurants, hotels, dry cleaners, automobile shops, all sorts of things. The point of this is that when you are a family-owned business, you have a glass ceiling, and that's your family. When you have a much larger enterprise, that provides an opportunity for upward mobility to identify young high school and college students, send them abroad for training, and have them rise up through the ranks, build a middle class, which is tied more towards the United States. And so let me conclude with my final remarks that where I think the United States particularly loses out in Africa is where is our brand? We've mentioned Djibouti, highly indebted to China. If you want to indent yourself to China, be like Djibouti. If you want to be have the Russians sort of take over, be like the Central African Republic. Where can we point to and say, this is what happens when you cast your lot with the United States? And unfortunately, across administrations, as we confine our strategy to 4 and 8 year cycles, I don't think we've achieved that. I would suggest Kenya. I would suggest Liberia, which has a special historical connections. But let me turn the floor back.
Wait, isn't it Rwanda? I read an article of yours about Rwanda as a kind of inspiring.
I think Rwanda has its faults. Rwanda has its benefits. But let me put it this way. I also don't think the United States should punish success. And even when we want to push a country in the right democratic trajectory, we've got to dispense with this notion that we engage in all over the world, but especially in Africa, that we are the only player in the sandbox. Take Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and put aside that a reformed absolute monarchy, that if you want to reform an absolute monarchy, you don't get a democracy, you get a reformed absolute monarchy. If we want to push Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia or another dictator, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, we got to be cognizant if we push them too far, we could be pushing them into the arms of the Saudis or the Russians. And will that ultimately be to the benefit of human rights in that region? Unfortunately, I don't think we have the sensitivity to the realities of the globe to understand that we can no longer dictate in the way perhaps we once did during the Cold War.
So I think we just have a minute or two left, but let me ask if anybody has a view of this. This makes sense to me that we should be encouraging American investment. I guess we have the Export-Import Bank, which provides some subsidy. We don't provide any insurance if you go into a risky place. That is, the government doesn't, and probably insurance companies don't want to do that. Is that a feasible project to have the government offer some kind of?
Well, this is what FTC does to some extent. Cameron could probably talk about it more. Former OPEC.
Yeah, so this is the administration, the Trump administration brought it online. It was conceived of even before that, but this is our response to what the Chinese have had for a long time, which is intended to be a kind of one-stop shop for U.S. businesses that are looking to go into places that are of high concern and high interest to the United States, but where going to commercial credit markets or debt markets or risk markets would be too costly and prohibitive to finance a project. So the United States government is willing to do that. So, you know, it's still early days in that project. But Africa is about 60% of the portfolio of the Development Finance Corporation right now. So it is supporting the work that it intended to. You know, I just want to close in answer to your last question about, you know, U.S. engagement. I think the problem that we see, and you see it in the strategy that the Biden administration wrote recently, and actually the project, you know, 2025 has lifted a section from Biden's Africa strategy and put it into their own strategy with respect to Africa. And it's this idea that Africa is a continent of the future, and it is a continent of the future. By 2050, 1 in 4 people on Earth will live in Africa, right? Africa is home to the kind of critical minerals and rare minerals that are only found in Africa. that will drive modern economies, right? It is increasingly a central artery in global shipping. It is geographically sort of center in our world. And so there are lots of reasons why Africa is the continent of the future. The problem is Africa is always the continent of the future, and it's never been the continent of today, right? There is always, the President Biden just canceled for the second time a trip to Africa in his term, because it's always, you're always able to knock it off of our list of priorities. And whenever it makes it onto the top of our list of priorities, it is there very, very episodically, and it never sustains. And I think that, the challenge that our administrations consecutively have had is that we can all acknowledge that it's the continent of the future, but unless we start treating that continent of the future as having importance to us today, and we start investing in the kinds of relationships, political, security, business relationships today, when the continent of the future becomes the continent of the now, we might be, third in line behind several other countries in vying for influence on the continent. So it has to become a priority sooner rather than later if we have to hope to have any chance in the future.
So we have one of the people in the audience asked this question, why is the U.S. always playing catch up rather than leading expectations for other countries? And my sense of this, which I think you probably will all agree with, is because we don't pay enough attention. And that is maybe one thing we could all agree on. We should pay more attention to Africa in the coming years, and hope the next administration, whoever is organizing it, will take that to heart. But now we are out of time, so I want to thank the panelists and the audience, people who asked questions, and people just listened. I think it was a good discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Professor Rabkin. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.